Okay, so I'm very happy to have virtually Professor Hinton from University of Toronto. I mean, I'm also fortunate to have experienced his course when he was teaching back in the 80s, late 80s. And today he's going to talk to us about deep learning. Just to give you a brief introduction, so Professor Hinton got his BA degree in England from the University of Cambridge in 1970 in experimental psychology, and then went on to do his PhD in AI from the University of Edinburgh, who you all know is one of the top places for artificial intelligence. He spent 5 years on the faculty at CMU, and then he came to Toronto around the time I was becoming a student there. And he was a fellow of the Canadian Institute of Advanced Research, and he was a professor in the Department of Computer Science. And he spent 3 years also from 88 to 2001 to set up the Gatsby Computational Neuroscience Unit at the University College London, and then returned to Toronto. And since 2013, as you all know, his work on neural nets and deep learning has took off basically, and he's spending his time between Toronto and Google. He's a member of the Royal Society and an honorary foreign member of the American Academy of Arts and Sciences, and a former president of the Cognitive Science Society, and he has got numerous awards. Some of them is, to name a few, is the David Rumelhart Prize, an Nitsky Award for Research Excellence, the Killian Prize for Engineering, and the Ernst Herzberg Gold Medal, which is Canada's top award in science engineering. Professor Hinton, as you know, does novel research in computational learning and machine learning algorithms. And his goal is, of course, discover a learning procedure that's efficient at finding complex structure in large, high-dimensional data sets, and show that this is similar to how the brain works. And this has been going on for at least 30 years that I know. He was one of the researchers who introduced the backpropagation algorithm and has been widely used, which has been widely used in practical applications, as you know. And his other contributions to neural networks include the Boltzmann machine, distributed representations, time delay neural nets, and many, many others. And he has, you know, as a scholar, the way he's, he has produced also top students who've gone to top universities, including U of T. And he's heading, of course, a very large laboratory at U of T. So, Professor Hinton, thanks for wanting to give a talk here, and you can start.
Okay, thank you. I want to start by saying what kinds of tasks deep learning should be good for. There's a spectrum of learning tasks, from typical statistics tasks, where you have relatively low dimensional data, there's a lot of noise in the data, there's not that much intricate structure in the data, and the main problem is not to be fooled by noise. Not to think you find structure when it isn't there. At the other end of the spectrum, there's artificial intelligence tasks, where you typically have much higher dimensional data. There may be noise, but it's not sufficient to obscure the structure if we process the data right. And there's a huge amount of structure, but the structure's complicated. So you can't extract the structure just by fitting simple models. The main problem is not to avoid being fooled by noise. The main problem is to find a way of representing this complicated structure so that you can learn the representations. And as an example, consider the mapping from pixel intensities to a caption for an image. You've got to get from a large number of pixel intensities to a string of words, and that's a complicated mapping. The backpropagation algorithm is capable of learning multiple layers of nonlinear features. It was invented many different times in the 70s and 80s, and it clearly had great promise, but by the 90s, people in machine learning had pretty much given up on it. And it was a disappointment to the people who invented it, because it didn't seem much good at learning multiple hidden layers. There were a few exceptions, like convolutional nets for reading handwritten characters. And it also didn't work well for recurrent networks, which was the most exciting application. In a recurrent network, the hidden units are connected to themselves, and you feed in the input over time. And potentially, it should be able to learn to run lots of little programs in parallel, communicating when they need to. And that would be a very powerful system. But when we tried training it with backpropagation, it didn't work very well. So most of you know this, but the way backpropagation works is you put in some input, and a feed-forward net, you feed it forward through hidden layers, and these hidden layers are basically linear filters with weights that I've shown as colored dots, and they apply the linear filter to the layer below. They then take what they get, and they put it through a nonlinear function, so it's a scalar through a nonlinear function, and then provide that to the layer above. And you put in an input, you pass it forward through the network, you look to see what the network gives you, you compare it with the correct answer, and you take some measure of the discrepancy, and then you send a signal backwards through the net that tells you how you would like to change the activity of each of the hidden units so as to reduce the discrepancy. Once you know that, once you've computed for each hidden unit how you'd like to change its activity, you can figure out how you'd like to change its weights so that on that particular training case, you change its activity in the way you want. Then to learn all these weights, what you do is you show it a small batch of examples, you compute the gradients for the weights for each example, you add them up, and you make a small change in the weights. So that's stochastic gradient descent. It's stochastic because you're picking the examples randomly. Now, people looked around in the 80s and 90s for why it wasn't working as well as expected. And one problem is it requires a lot of training data. And most training data is unlabeled. And this requires labeled data. The main problem seemed to be that the learning time didn't scale well, particularly in nets with multiple hidden layers. And those were the most interesting nets. And a final problem, which everybody thinks of, but actually isn't the main problem, is that it can get stuck in poor local optima. It turns out that for big nets, particularly deep ones, almost all of the local optima are almost equally good. So it doesn't really matter which one you find. So that's actually not the main problem. One way of trying to overcome the limits of backpropagation is to use unsupervised learning. So the idea is we keep the efficiency and simplicity of using stochastic gradient descent for adjusting the weights. But instead of trying to predict the label in the image, we just try and build a model of the image. That is, we try and make a stochastic generative model that's capable of generating images like the ones we see in the training set. So now we're doing computer graphics rather than computer vision. And the first question is, what kind of generative model should we try and learn? So you might have thought we would look at what they do in computer graphics and copy that, which would have been the smart thing to do. We actually just stuck with the kinds of units we were used to. So we used binary stochastic units. These are just like the units normally used in backpropagation, the normal logistic units, except that instead of outputting a real number, they compute a real number between 0 and 1 using that sigmoid curve I'm showing you. And then they use that real number to decide on a probability of turning on, and then they output either a 1 or a 0 with that probability. So I've shown you the equation there for the probability that unit I will output a 1, and it's just 1 over e to the minus the bias of that unit and the sum of the inputs it's getting from all other units. Now, when you take those stochastic binary units, you can hook them up into a generative model. And the obvious way to do it is... Whoops, I've got the wrong tool. Well, I'll tell you what I'm going to... Oh, hang on. I need to go get a different talk. Which I'm not sure I have. Okay, so here's what I did. I made the talk a bit simpler, and I have overwritten the talk I wanted to give, for which you have the slides, with the slightly simpler talk. So I'm going to give the slightly simpler talk, and you have the slides for the more complicated talk I was going to give. So you get both talks if you want. This talk is actually much easier to understand. So we take those stochastic binary units. I'm just going to go forward to check I really did overwrite it. Yep, I really did overwrite it. And we hook them up into a system that uses symmetric connectors and only has one layer of connectors. So the system looks like this, you can see my cursor. It's got visible units and it's got hidden units, and they're connected to each other. The visibles are connected to the hidden, but there's no connections between the hidden units and no connections between the visible units. So in this simple system, which is called a restricted Boltzmann machine, the probability of turning on a hidden unit, given a visible vector, is just this logistic function I showed you before of the total input that the hidden unit is getting from the visible vector. So think of the visible vector as pixels, and think of the hidden units as feedback vectors. So there's a nice simple equation for the probability of hidden unit J turning on. And you'll notice it's completely independent of what its neighbors do. So in a simple bipartite architecture like this, the hidden units behave independently given the states of the visible units. So if I'm given a visible vector, I can easily decide which feature detectors should be on, or rather what the probability should be of being on. Also, because the whole thing's symmetric, if I'm given a bunch of feature detectors, I can easily decide which pixels should be on. So from the active feature detectors, the ones that turn on, you can reconstruct, or try to reconstruct, the pixels, if they were binary pixels. I've left out the bias terms in all these equations just to make the math simpler. Now, systems of that kind are governed by an energy function. There's a joint energy for a global configuration of the system. That is, if you put the pixels into some vector state V, and you put the feature detectors into some vector state H, then the energy of that joint configuration is just going to be to do with the pairs of units that are on. So if VI is on, and if HJ is on, then you count the weight between them. And if it's a big positive weight, that's low energy, because of the minus sign. So low energy states are ones that have pairs of units with big positive weights between them turned on. If you turn on a pair of units with a big negative weight between them, that'll be high energy, and high energy is bad. So one nice thing about this energy function is it has very simple derivatives. If you differentiate it with respect to Wij, you get that the derivative of the energy with respect to Wij is just VIHJ. It's just the product of the states of these two units. So it's very easy locally at a synapse, at a connection between two units, to compute the derivative of the energy. If you think how that energy function defines the probability of a joint configuration, this is the Boltzmann distribution, where we say the probability of a joint configuration is e to the minus the energy of that joint configuration, normalized by that same quantity summed over all possible joint configurations. Now, it's not obvious, but if you run the sampling algorithm I gave you, that is, if you keep running these equations, so you start with any state here, and you go backwards and forwards and backwards and forwards and backwards and forwards, the system will reach a stationary distribution. That is, a distribution where it's still changing states, but the probability of finding an end state stays constant. And in that stationary distribution, this will be true. The probability of finding this joint configuration will be proportional to e to the minus the energy of that joint configuration. So low energy ones, you're going to find more probably. What's more, there's a linear relation between log probabilities and energies, and there's a linear relation between energies and weights. Now, if you want to know the probability that this system, if you run it backwards and forwards, will produce a particular visible vector, V, then to get that probability, you have to sum over all possible states of H. And that's what this is. The bottom line stays the same. And so that tells you the probability that this little bipartite model, if you run it backwards and forwards using the equations I showed you for a long time, that's the probability that if you look on the visible units after doing that, you'll find a visible vector V. And what you'd like to do, if I show you a bunch of images, is change the weights on the connections so that the vectors that you actually observe in the training set get to be more probable. You'd like to maximize the log probability of the observed visible vectors, that is, the observed images. And it's not immediately obvious that that's going to be simple. All the weights are interacting here. But it turns out there's a very simple learning rule that Terry Osinoski and I discovered in 1983. And the learning rule looks like this for this restricted case of a Boltzmann machine. In fact, the learning rule is much more general, but I'll just talk about it in these restricted Boltzmann machines. If you start by putting a vector here at time t equals 0, and then you decide for each feature detector whether it should be on or off, and you do that stochastically by taking the input, putting it through the logistic function, using that as a probability of turning on, and then you update the visible units, and then you update the hidden units, and you go backwards and forwards for a long time, then there's a simple learning rule that only depends on the correlations you get when you're putting the data in, and the correlations between a visible and a hidden unit that you get after you've gone backwards and forwards for a long time. If you want to decide how long to go backwards and forwards, if you're a statistician, you go backwards and forwards until you're close to the stationary distribution. If you're a physicist, you go backwards and forwards until you are close to thermal equilibrium. That's just saying the same thing in different jargon. If you're a computer scientist, you just go backwards and forwards until you get bored. Basically, until you've forgotten where you started. And now the learning rule is just the difference between how often a pixel and a hidden unit are on together when you're showing it data, and how often they're on together when you've gone backwards and forwards so many times it's forgotten the data and it's just fantasizing from what it believes. And so that's the learning rule. And that's the exact maximum likelihood of learning rule. So if you change Wij in proportion to that difference of expectations, where this first term means the expectation of these two guys being on when I'm sampling from data, or when I'm sampling from V in this case, but I put V on the visible units, and I'm sampling the hidden units at time zero, and this is the expectation of them being on when I've run the chain for a long time. So I'm sampling from my model. So it's a very simple learning rule. It's a very attractive learning rule, but it's got some problems. The first problem is you have to run this chain for a long time and you don't know how long. The second problem is that this is the difference of two noisy expectations. And so once the gradient becomes small towards the end of learning, this is an extremely noisy signal. The noise is much bigger than the signal. So for a long time, this learning rule was regarded as an interesting curiosity that was going to be no good in practice. And that was probably true. And then the Netflix competition came along. And actually what Netflix now uses for recommending movies is the average of the predictions of two different models. One is called matrix factorization, and the other is these restricted Boltzmann machines. And so they use these in practice, and they train them on huge data sets, and they work about as well as matrix factorization, but give very different errors. And so combining the two is what Netflix does. So that's a practical use of these restricted Boltzmann machines. Now, one thing that made them practical was, after 17 years, I discovered how to make them go a million times as fast. And the way you do it is this. Instead of running that chain up and down and up and down many, many times, you just run the chain up and down and up again. So instead of running it for hundreds of steps, you just run it for two steps. And you take this difference in expectations. And so now your weight change is proportional to that. This is not following the gradient of the log light year. It's following the gradient approximately of a variational band, and it works pretty well. It doesn't learn as good models as you get if you did maximum likelihood, but it's much faster, and the features that it learns are good enough for the purposes we're going to put it to later. So we now have an efficient way of learning features from images. We just put in the image, we start with random weights, we activate our features, we reconstruct the image, we activate our features again from the reconstructed image, and we look at this difference of expectations and change the weight in proportion to that, and that will learn good features for images. This is the binary version. You can make these visible units real values and that'll still work, and you can do all sorts of variations of this. But this is the basic algorithm. It goes a million times as fast because it goes 100 times as fast by just running the chain for only two steps instead of a few hundred. And it goes another 10,000 times as fast because it took me 17 years to think of it, and computers went 10,000 times as fast in that time. Okay. So the reason this algorithm is interesting, it's interesting because it learns good models of data, but it's interesting because it can train a layer of feature detectors, and then you can apply it recursively. So you train a layer of binary feature detectors on images, and then you take the activation vectors of those feature detectors when they're being driven by data, and you treat those as data. So you map all of your images to the weights that your first restricted Boltzmann machine learned, and now you get binary vectors of feature activities, and you just treat those as data and do it again. And so now you can learn features of features. So to simplify rather, you might expect that the first layer of feature detectors might learn to find things like little edges in images, and the next layer of feature detectors might learn to find things like long curved edges, or it might learn to find corners. And you can keep doing this. So you can learn more and more complicated features. And the hope is that if you learn many layers of features, then your high-level features, which are detecting combinations of features in the layer below, will be much closer to features that are good for identifying objects than the raw pixel. So that just by running this learning algorithm and training things greedily one layer at a time, you can learn high-level features that are good for recognizing objects. Now, one question is this algorithm really building a big model that gets better as you add each layer? And the answer is yes. You can see the proof that there's something that's getting better each time you add a layer. And that proof is in a paper in 2006 called A Fast Learning Algorithm for Deep Neural Networks in Neural Computation. And the proof is complicated. And what's improving is not the probability of your model generating the data. What's improving is the variational bind on that probability. Each time you add another layer of features, you get a new variational bind, and that variational bind is better than the previous one you had, provided you train it. Actually, in practice, we violate all the assumptions of the proof. But it's nice to have a proof to show that you could be doing something sensible if you were willing to part of it. So now what we can do is take an image, or any other kind of data, and we can learn lots of layers of feature detectors without requiring any labels. So we've got over the problem of needing a big label data. This is also fairly efficient, because you're only learning one layer at a time. Once we've done that, we can then add a final layer of, the final layer is decision view. So, for multi-way classification, it would be a big software. And that final layer, we then train the weights of that final layer by... Let me just ask a question. Are you guys getting any feedback of my delayed?
Sounds good.
Hello? Can anybody hear me?
Very little. Yeah, very little, so it's not it's negligible.
Okay. I'm just going to try and get rid of it. Let me say, I'll try and get rid of it, and I may fail. Okay, it should have gone now. So, we stick a layer of decision units on top of this deep net that we've trained, unsupervised. The only things we haven't pre-trained are the weights from the last layer of feature detectors to the label units. And then we use backpropagation on this whole system. So what's happening is backpropagation is now starting from a very good point where it has a whole bunch of very sensible feature detectors that have been learned by trying to model the structure in the data. And that overcomes many of the limits of standard backpropagation. So, what can you do with this pre-training algorithm? Well, a couple of my students tried it on speech recognition. So they took a standard database called Timid, and the input was 11 frames of coefficients extracted from the sound wave, You use what's called Mel-Kapstrel coefficients, and you extract 13 of those at each 10 millisecond time step. And then you make a frame of 39 coefficients by taking the 13 MFCCs and their differences, and their differences are differences. So you're kind of drawing the attention of the system to temporal differences. And then you put in 11 frames, so that's 110 milliseconds worth of those Mel-Kapstrel coefficients. And that's the input of the neural net. And what the neural net is asked to output is the probability that the central frame in that bunch of 11 frames is a particular piece of a particular phoneme. So you model each phoneme as having three parts with a little hidden Markov model. You've got 61 phonemes. And so in your 61 hidden Markov models, you have 183 possible states. And you're asking your neural net to make predictions about which part of which phoneme this part of the sound wave corresponds to. And of course, you don't know for sure, so it has to give you a probability distribution across 183 labels. And so what the students did was they pre-trained actually 8 hidden layers of 2,000 binary hidden units. And there's only about 3 million labeled examples in this data set. And this has many more parameters than that. So between each pair of layers, there's 4 million weights, because the layers are totally connected. So this is a model that's got hugely more parameters than labeled examples. But because it's pre-trained to model the structure of the input, it gets far more constraint than it would if it was just trying to model the labels. And so this net now did in 2009, slightly better than the state of the art on Timit. We can now make this work much better, and it turns out it's much better not to use Mel-Kapstrel coefficients. They were designed to throw away lots of data so that a small computer could handle speech. It's much better just to use raw filter bank outputs, and they contain more information. And the neural net can decide how to pre-process those. It's got lots of hidden layers, and any pre-processing that needs to be done, it can decide how to do by actually looking at the data. It's better at designing feature detectors than people are. So someone at Microsoft called Li Deng got to review our paper on this, and he realized this was going to be a breakthrough in speech recognition. And George Dahl then went to Microsoft as an intern and applied exactly the same net to large vocabulary speech recognition, and where there were, I think it was 8,000 possible labels, because they have finer distinctions between phonemes. And it blew away the state of the art. And within a few years, all of the acoustic models in all of the state of the art speech recognizers are now using these deep neural nets as acoustic models. So that was the first big success of this kind of learning algorithm. One question you might ask is, how many layers and how wide should they be? And one very good property of these systems is, it doesn't matter that much. If you use half as many layers and make them twice as wide, that'll be fine. If you use half as many layers and make them the same width, that'll be fine. If you use half as many layers and make them half as wide, that won't work quite as well, but it'll work pretty well. So these nets are fairly insensitive to the depth and to the width. Basically, if you make them big, they work well. If you make them very shallow, they don't. So back in the 80s and 90s, people were typically training backpropagation with nets with one hidden layer, and those typically don't work as well. So one reason why backpropagation works well in these pre-trained nets is learning one layer at a time scales much better than trying to learn all the layers at once. It's a much simpler problem. And then we only start the backpropagation through all layers when we're already close to a solution. So gradient descent is just being asked to do a local search. It's not asked to be asked to find a region in a great big nonlinear space just by following gradients. It doesn't have to find the sensible region. It just has to do a local search within that sensible region that's found by the pre-training. The second reason why this is nice is because it's much better at dealing with overfitting when you don't have many labels. Most of the information that you have in the weights of the feature detectors comes from the attempt to model the distribution of input vectors, the unsupervised learning, and the information in the labels is only used for fine-tuning those feature detectors to get the category boundaries right. And typically, the feature detectors don't change much when you fine-tune. So you can use this type of backpropagation when you have very, very little labeled data. So I just want to sort of summarize what's going on here and try and give you an intuition as to why it's the sensible thing to do for something like vision. On the left, we have a picture of how you might generate pairs of images and labels. And the way you do it is you take the stuff in the world and you take a picture of it, and then you make a label that's a function of the picture. So if labels were things like the bottom left-hand corner of pixel is turned on, that would be a good model of how we got labels. But that's not what you believe. What you believe is on the right, which is the stuff in the world, like a field with a cow in it. We take a picture of it, and so we get an image of a field with a cow in it. And the reason that cow is the right label for that is because in the real stuff, there's a cow. The label isn't really a function of the image. The label's a function of what the image is showing you. What's more, the pathway from the real world to the image is a very high bandwidth pathway. And the pathway from the real world to the label is a very low bandwidth pathway. So the right way to associate labels with images is to first try and invert this high bandwidth pathway. And that's what the pre-training is doing. You're trying to get from pixels that have correlations in them to the stuff that caused them. And we know that can be done because we do it routinely. We look out there and we see what's really there. Occasionally we make mistakes and that gets psychologists all excited. But the sort of first order information is that we do vision and we get it right. So we know that you can get from the image to the stuff. And an image contains hugely more information than a label. If I say cow, you don't know whether it's a brown cow or a black and white cow. You don't know how far away it is. You don't know what the background is. You don't know whether it's alive or dead. You don't know whether it's upside down. You know all of those things if I show you an image. So the right way to associate labels with images is to first figure out what's going on in the image and then associate labels with these underlying variables that explain what's going on in the image. Now, it turns out that you don't actually need this pre-training if you've got a lot of labeled data. If you don't have much labeled data, it's very important and gives you much better generalization. But after we got deep learning working nicely using this pre-training, we discovered that as long as you initialize the weights very carefully, you can train deep nets without pre-training, provided you have a lot of labeled data. Now, the regime people work in is not that regime of having a lot of labeled data. It turns out that synapses are much cheaper than experiences. You have 10 to the 14 synapses, and you only have 10 to the 9 seconds to live. Actually, 2 times 10 to the 9, which is lucky. So you have to use up 100,000 synapses a second. Synapses are cheap, and experiences are expensive. So you are living in the regime where you have many more parameters than labels. And that means you need to do a lot of unsupervised learning. And if we had enough computation, whenever we fit models to data, we should always try and live in this regime. When you've got complicated data, it's much better to have many more parameters than training examples and to use very strong regularization. So the second big success of deep learning was for object recognition. This was a bit unfair. Yann LeCun had been doing convolutional nets for object recognition for many years and had developed the technology and had made them work very well on all sorts of things. And the computer vision community basically just ignored him. They did crazy things like he would submit a paper where he beat the state of the art, and the computer vision community would say, well, yes, okay, it beats the state of the art, but only by a little bit. And anyway, we don't understand what's going on inside, so it's of no interest. It was quite bizarre. So then in 2012, there was a competition where there was a big training set. Previously, object recognition competitions had training sets that were much too small for neural networks to be able to do much. But in this one, there's a big training set and many classes. So there were 1.2 million high-resolution training images, 1,000 different classes of object. The labels weren't totally reliable, and these were real images from the web that had many things going on in them. So we counted as getting the right answer if in your top five guesses you get the same label as the training data has. A lot of really good computer vision groups entered this competition over the years, and in 2012, really good groups from Oxford and INRIA entered. And the computer vision systems they were using in 2012 were multi-stage pipelines with lots of hand-engineered features that they put a lot of work into. They were basically descendants of David Lowe's SIFT features, but then put into a big framework with pyramids and lots of hand engineering. And they did some optimization, but they weren't doing end-to-end optimization. And the results looked like this. The people using the state-of-the-art computer vision systems, or technology, were getting about 26% correct. And you can see from these results that they're kind of asymptoting towards 25%. They're all fairly close together. A student of mine in his bedroom at home using two GPU boards ran a deep convolutional neural net and with various tricks in it, and he got 16%. So he almost halved the error rate. And this completely changed the way computer vision people do object recognition. So in particular, the Oxford University group, led by Andrew Zisserman, looked at our result, and they said, hey, that's much better. We're going to switch to doing that. And they've now actually succeeded in halving the error rate that Alex was getting using nets that are just like Alex's net, with a few more tricks, and much deeper. So if you make them like 17 layers deep instead of 7 layers deep, which Alex is using, they work even better. So I'm explaining to you how Alex's neural net worked. It was a convolutional net of the kind introduced by Yann LeCun when he was at Toronto in 1987. It had 7 hidden layers and max pooling layers. The early layers were convolutional, the last two layers were globally connected, and that's where most of the parameters were. It didn't use logistic units, it used rectified linear units, which are much easier to train and slightly more powerful. And on the globally connected layers, it used a new regularization technique called dropout, which made it work considerably better. So let me show you some examples from the test set and what the network guesses. So the bars are the network's confidence in its answers, or probabilities associated with the answers. So it's pretty sure the first one's a cheetah, but if it's not, it's a leopard. And you'll notice its wrong answers are all pretty sensible. In this case, it's pretty sure it's a bullet train, but if it's not, it might be a car or a subway train or an electric locomotive. So again, its wrong answers are mostly pretty sensible. And notice the bullet train is only a small fraction of the image. It learns all sorts of things like what people will typically attend to in images. Here's something from a catalog, because the data set also contains catalog images. And if you look at its answers, you can see that it needs glasses. So it thinks that might be a frying pan, presumably because it can't see that the handle of the frying pan isn't actually solid, it's actually two chains. It confuses that with the solid handle of a frying pan. But you can see that all its answers are pretty sensible. So I'm going to explain how the net, some of the details. First of all, convolutional nets. The idea of a convolutional net is if a feature is worth having in one location in the image, it's worth having everywhere. So we're going to tie together a bunch of features that are really replications of the same feature. So in that image, connections that are the same color have the same weight on them. And so this is three different copies of a feature detector that's operating on three different 3x3 patches of the image. And when we train it, we insist that those weights stay the same. We compute derivatives for each weight on each connection, but then we average those derivatives to make sure that when we change them, the weights stay the same. by replicating features like that, we get lots of feature activations with not many parameters. And of course, we have more than one type of feature, so we have many replicated features per layer. And those allow each patch of the image to be represented in several different ways by several different feature activations. So it's easy to backpropagate when you have constraints between weights. You simply compute the gradient for W1 and compute the gradient for W2 and make the change in W1 and W2 be just the sum or the average of those two gradients, and then they'll stay the same. So W1 and W2 are two weights on different replicated feature detectors that are constrained to be the same. The convolutional nets use pooling to get some translation invariance. And so what they do is they take, say, four neighboring replicated feature detectors, and instead of producing the four numbers that those things give, the four activations, instead of sending those to the next layer, they just pick the biggest one and send that to the next layer, without saying which of the four was producing it. So they're blurring across space a bit. I don't like this, but I have to admit it works very well. It reduces the number of inputs to the next layer, so you can have more feature detectors, more different kinds of feature detectors, and it gives a little bit of translation invariance, and if you go up through many layers, you end up with a lot of translation invariance. You could average, or you could take the maximum, and the maximum works best. Then another trick is to use rectified linear units. So this is a very simple non-linearity. It's just the output is the maximum of zero and the x that you get by applying a linear filter to the layer below. So it's linear when it's above zero, but because it can't go below zero, it's a non-linear function. And surprisingly, these are quite easy to train with gradient descent, and they're considerably easier in deep nets than logistic units. I have complicated arguments about why that's true that I won't get into. The last trick we used was dropout. And I can explain dropout very quickly because I'm running out of time. I'll explain it for a very simple net. So suppose you have a neural net where you have some pixels down here and some classes here, and you have one layer of hidden units. And the way dropout works is, each time you show it an image, you randomly leave out each hidden unit with a probability of a half. One nice thing is a half works almost as well as most other numbers, and so you can just always use a half, so there's no free parameter there. And so we just randomly leave out some of the hidden units. And now the network has to try and get the right answer using the hidden units that are available to it. And they'll get some gradients. But whenever we do use a hidden unit, we're using the same incoming weights and outgoing weights as any other time we use that hidden unit. So we can think of this as an exponential number of different architectures, all the different models you can get by dropping out a subset of the hidden units, which is 2 to the h different models if there's h hidden units, and they're all equiprobable. But all of these models share parameters. And because they share parameters, it's possible to train them, even though most models never get a single training example, and a few models get one training example. You'd have thought one training example wasn't enough to train a model. But it is if that model is averaging parameters with a huge number of other models. And that's a much better regularizer than regressing towards zero, because you're regressing towards the weights that other models would like. Now, you can apply dropout in multiple layers. If you try applied in just one layer, there's some nice theory to it. At test time, if you simply use all of the hidden units, but you halve their outgoing weights, then they have the same expected effect on the decision units as they would if you picked them with a probability of a half and used the full outgoing weight. So you're getting the same expectation, but with much less noise. And actually, if you halve the outgoing weights of all these hidden units, it's exactly equivalent to computing the geometric mean of the predictions of all 2 to the h models. But it's a very efficient way to get an ensemble average. If you have more hidden layers, you just do exactly the same thing. You use dropout and you halve the outgoing weights at test time for all of the layers. It's not exactly computing a geometric mean, but it's close enough and it works very well. And you can actually do the same for the input layer too. And that trick for the input layer had already been discovered by Yoshio Benjo's group. It creates a lot more training examples. They're noisy, and at test time you don't do the dropout, but this helps to regularize the system a lot. So now we can go back and look at what was actually wrong with backpropagation in 1986 when we first introduced it and tried it. We drew all the wrong conclusions. The real reasons it failed were the data sets were thousands of times too small. So we did know it was hard to get labeled data, but we didn't realize how much more data you'd need. The computers were millions of times too slow, and we didn't really realize that. We initialized the weights in a stupid way. Pre-training is a better way to initialize them, or just initializing them to random values but choosing the scales very carefully is fine if you've got a lot of labeled data. And we used the wrong type of nonlinearity. Rectified linear units work a bit better, and they're much faster to train. So once neural networks started working in the mid-2000s, Jeff Dean at Google, who built a lot of the Google infrastructure, decided that if we had enough computation, these neural networks might do amazing things. And he created a group called the Brain Team that built a lot of infrastructure for making it possible to train big neural networks on lots of data. And the infrastructure has now been upgraded so we can use GPUs as well. And it's beginning to look as if Jeff Dean made a very good bet. So I'm going to finish by talking about recurrent networks. I'm going to be fairly brief on the technical details, but I'm going to show you some results. In a recurrent network, you get input, and the input comes in over time. So the horizontal axis here is time. The input goes to one or more layers of hidden units. So we can still have hidden layers, but now the hidden units are connected to themselves over time. So it's a recurrent network. And in this diagram, all of the arrows that have the same color will have the same weight matrix on them. So you're reusing the same weights at each time step. And the output, you can give an output at each time step, or you can wait till the end to give an output. And you can train the whole thing by backpropagation through time. So let's suppose that we get some output here that the net produces at time 3, and we have some desired output, we know what it should be. We take our measure of the discrepancy, and we can backpropagate that through all the pathways in the network. So we can backpropagate that, for example, straight down through this pathway to get derivatives for these weights. We can backpropagate it backwards through this pathway to get derivative for the recurrent weights in the second hidden layer, or we can backpropagate it sort of like this. We backpropagate through all of those pathways efficiently, and then we can train all of these weight matrices. And each instance of a weight matrix will get different derivatives, but we average them, and so now we can update the weights. And we train it with little batches, updating the weights each time. And if you initialize the weights sensibly, and you use a slightly more complicated kind of architecture, which I'm not going to go into the details of, it works just great. And these are very powerful models because they have two properties. The first is they've got distributed hidden states, so they can efficiently encode internal state. Hidden Markov models can't do that. In a hidden Markov model, if you view it as a generative model, if you want to encode twice as much information about the history, you have to have the square of the number of states. Because a hidden Markov model encodes its history in which state it's at. These have distributed states, so if you want twice as much information about the history, you just need twice as many hidden units, not the square of the number of units. Linear dynamical systems have efficient representations, but they're linear, so they can't model complicated nonlinear things. So these recurrent neural networks combine good aspects of hidden Markov models and of linear dynamical systems. And they work better when they have many hidden layers. We use backpropagation through time, as I explained already, to train them. And now I'm going to show you how we can do machine translation. And we're going to do machine translation in a really dumb way. is the kind of method that you would have thought really wouldn't work. For each language, we're going to have an encoder recurrent network and a decoder recurrent neural network. And then if we want to translate English to French, we're going to use the English encoder and the French decoder. So what the English encoder does is it reads the word of English, it reads the sentence of English one word at a time until it gets to the full stop. And then the final hidden state of the English encoder network, we're going to say, is the thought that the sentence expresses. And I really mean the thought. So you can say, John thought, and then you put anything you like in quotes, like John thought down, or John thought, where should we go for lunch? And you can give this recurrent network any sentence, and I'm going to claim that the final state of the recurrent network is what the recurrent network thinks. That's the thought that it thinks is expressed by the sentence. It's converting a sentence into a thought. People who do believe in symbolic logic, for some bizarre reason, think that just because sentences consist of strings of words, they must be represented inside your head by strings of symbols. I think the only place the symbols are is in the input. Inside your head is just big vectors. And I'm going to give an argument in favor of that by showing you could do machine translation at state-of-the-art levels with no symbols inside your head. Okay, so an input word first gets converted into a big vector that represents all sorts of things about that word, that's learned. Then that goes into the hidden state. And the encoder network ends up with some big hidden vector that expresses the thought, that captures the thought expressed by the sentence, where it will do after we train it. We then take that thought and we feed it to the French decoder network. The first thing the French decoder network does is makes a guess about what the first word should be given that thought. And it'll guess that the first word is quite likely to be le, quite likely to be la, and it may be something else. And let's suppose we did the following. We look at the distribution that the French decoder network produces, and we pick a word from that distribution. So suppose we pick le. We then take the word we picked, and we feed it back as input. So we take le, we feed his input, it gets converted into a word vector. That gets fed into the hidden units. I only used one hidden layer because that was all I could be bothered to in the diagram. And then the French decoder predicts a distribution for the next word. And so if we pick from that distribution and feed that word back in, we can ask it, okay, given that was an encoder, what do you think the third word is? And this process of letting it produce a distribution, which is an entirely deterministic process, and then us randomly picking a word, will allow us from the French decoder network to get a probability distribution across French translations. Each time we do this picking, we'll get a different translation of the English sentence. And the amazing thing is that this is now a state-of-the-art for a medium-sized database. The way you train it is obviously on the training data, you know what the first word should be. And so suppose the first word really should be le. You look at the probability, or rather the log probability associates with le, and you try and raise that log probability. So you backpropagate the difference between what you'd like the log probability to be and what the log probability actually is, and you send that backwards through, in this case, through the thought vector, and then backwards through the encoder network, and that's how you train the encoder network. Later on, for the third word, you're going to send the third word conditioned on the first two words, you're going to send the log probability for the correct third word backwards through the decoder and through the encoder, and you're going to be able to train both the decoder and the encoder that way. And during training, you only need to have input the correct words to the decoder. So it took a man year, a few people working for a few months to make this system work. It beats the state of the art on a medium-sized data set, just slightly. It's not as good as the state of the art on really big data sets yet, but I think this is going to be the way we do machine translation in a few years' time. If you think about it, this translates from one language directly to another language without going via English. And for something like the European Parliament, you could input a Dutch sentence to via the Dutch encoder, and then you get 25 different decodings of it in the 25 languages of the European Parliament. And that would, when you backpropagate through those decoders, it will act as like 25-way stereo on the thought expressed by the sentence. And that'll get rid of all sorts of ambiguities you might get when you translate into another very similar language. So the more different the language is, the better. And it doesn't seem to me unreasonable to suppose that in another 10 to 20 years, we might be able to put an English decoder net and 25 encoder nets all on one small chip that you could fit in your ear. Okay, the last thing I'm going to talk about is combining a decoder for language with the convolutional net for vision. So suppose we take the convolutional net that's already being trained on ImageNet, and we have a decoder net that's going to try and produce sentences, and what we feed it with is the last hidden layer of the convolutional net. We'll define the last hidden layer of that net as a percept. That's what the convolutional net sees in the image. It gets these percept in order to try and recognize objects. That's how it's trained. But we'd like to know what's going on in that last hidden layer. And people say, well, you can't tell what's going on inside a neural net. Sort of deep in this net, we have no way of knowing what it's doing. That's one of the big objections to neural nets. Well, there's a very easy answer to that now. You just ask it. So you put the percept in, you actually map it through a matrix, and that's the initial state of the recurrent neural net. You could also, if you like, keep the percept there for the whole time while you're producing the caption. And then you train the recurrent neural net to say what it sees in the image. And to do that, you need a big training database. Microsoft fortunately produced multiple captions for 200,000 images. And so now you can train a decoder net, and several groups have done this, to say what's in the image. I think the group at Google, with Oriol Vinyals and Ilya Sutskever and Sami Bengio people, I'm not sure Ilya was actually involved in that, they got the best captions, I think, but many other groups got almost equally good captions. And let me show you some of the captions. So you show it that, this is a test image, and it says two pizzas sitting on top of a stovetop oven. The correct caption is three different types of pizzas on a stovetop on top of a stove. So you can see there's all sorts of fine detail that it doesn't get, but it basically can tell you what that image is about. In this image, it says a group of people shopping in an outdoor market. It doesn't get what the real caption has, which is that there's crouching going on, which is very significant for us. It makes it a different kind of street market. But it's pretty much got what's there. And it's always good to have a baby in your talk. So this is a close-up of a child holding a stuffed animal. Not quite as good as the real caption. But if a neural net can look at a bunch of pixels and can produce that string of words, it's hard to say that it doesn't understand quite a bit about what's going on, if that's a test image. This suggests a nice new form of the Turing test, where you give a system both an image and a question, and it must answer the question. Because that's a highly constrained thing, and it's easy to see if it understands. If you give it that image and say, what's the baby holding? And it says a stuffed animal, or a stuffed bear, or a teddy bear, it understands. And with the normal Turing test, you can say, well, it rearranged the words in the question, and did some lookup in big tables without understanding things, and got something that looks like a reasonable answer. But if you can rearrange the pixels to produce a reasonable caption, that really is understanding. And so I don't think you can make the same objection. Okay, I'm done.